Dark Stories, the podcast. Season 1. Coal River, True Crime. Opening an intimate window on the raw violence, resilience, humour and dumb luck characterising the crime stories from colonial Newcastle. Case File. The Sandhills. Returning from an ocean swim, on a hot day in January 1866, the four boys' broomstick legs hopped effortlessly over the vast sandhills separating the township from its peninsular beaches. As they neared the wooden planked pathway connecting to the town proper, one of them noticed something round, white, and shining on the sand.
They shared their find, a smallish, jawless human skull, like it was some otherworldly jewel. It felt addictively smooth in their spindly hands, except for a few wiry residual strands of auburn hair. The left side was perfectly white in consequence of it being exposed to the air, while the right side was of brownish hue from being embedded in the sand. Just above its mesmerizingly empty eye sockets was a hole through the right temple, about the size of a small bullet. As the eldest and biggest of the four boys, William took custody of the prize, only to have his father deny it entrance to their home. By evening, it was on display in a bakery in Watt Street, the Broughtons' neighbour having quickly recognised the skull's banal, carny potential, which he hoped to commercially exploit as a preternatural confrontation with death.
By the following day, authorities had taken possession of the skull, and with the assistance from the four boys, they unearthed an almost perfectly intact skeleton, angelically lying as if in a mould. Nearby it was found a single frayed coat button and some loose, matted strings of reddish hair. 3 months after, in the cool Darkwood lounge of the Metropolitan Hotel, an inquest would declare the skeleton had been beneath the sands for at least 3 years. The former jailer knew well the Leviathan peaks where the skeleton was found, viz. On the sandhills, between the jail and the town.
"I do not believe that there has been anybody interned there for the last 43 years. Where the remains were found, the ground is much higher on account of the sand being blown up from the sea beach. I think it was much higher 3 or 4 years ago than it is now."
The local doctor assisting the coroner concluded the bones were the remains of a female, name unknown, just under 4 feet 5 inches in height and around 25 years of age. The doctor noted that once the skull and lower jaw were reunited, the complete skeleton was perfect even to its most minute and delicate parts, apart from the temple perforation that he speculated was not caused by a bullet. If such were the case, the inner table would be more splintered than the outward.
"I have no doubt the injury to the skull was during life by some force of violence. It must have been by a blow of some pointed instrument."
When William's father was called on to confirm his son's find, he explained that in the days before he appeared with it, he had, by some coincidence, been told by Captain Lackey of the Lily and Captain McCallum of the Phyllis that in going across the sandhill, one of them struck his foot against a skull before they threw it some distance. Like those now departed officers, William Sr. dismissed his son's find as the remains as aboriginal or some other worthless flotsam washed up by the ocean. For many in the town, though, especially long-term sandhill residents of the East End, the evidence soon pointed back 4 years to the night of January the 4th, 1862, when a local woman, Margaret Ray, vanished into the dark and out of life.
The sandblasted and ramshackle houses of the East End stoically shouldered the Olympian sandhills. For the shift-working maritime, mining and factory families, it was an overcrowded, rough and tumble world of undesired intimacy. No place for secrets. Margaret shared a surprisingly well-kept, askance-leaning terrace with her ship carpenter husband, James, and their lodger couple, the Masseys. Both the women were ill at the time of Margaret's disappearance, Mrs. Massey with consumption, and Margaret with puerperal fever, an infection of the female reproductive organs progressing after a miscarriage or, as in Margaret's case, giving birth. The only cure was to ride out the days of debilitating fever and fierce abdominal pain. In more severe and potentially fatal cases like Margaret's, the fever remained dangerously persistent and high, often resulting in paranoid or hallucinatory episodes. This had made Margaret incapable of safely caring for her new child, who was removed into the care of relatives. Despite this, Margaret was said to have been slow but calm when she was last seen before 10 p.m. on the Tuesday evening, having performed her own ablutions, changed into fresh clothes, and eaten a bowl of simple food.
Her husband would tell police he worked the afternoon shift at a Stockton shipyard that Tuesday. He'd been delayed crossing the river back to Newcastle by a heavy storm. He made it home around midnight to find the front door open, a heavy brass candlestick discarded in the hallway, clothes scattered about, some money taken, and his wife missing. Except for a mischievously unfounded sighting of a severed arm, days of search in the Sandhills, township, and peninsula beaches would find no trace of Margaret. The local police, an inept mix of ex-convicts diluted with new recruits from Britain, decided that illness and grog had given way to suicidal madness after Margaret's treating doctor told how he had given strict instructions that she was not to be left alone and that she was to be allowed no spirits, an instruction which seems to have been disobeyed in both particulars, although from no fault of her husband's, as we understand. On this information, it was supposed that Margaret had destroyed herself, as she was heard to say that she would make away with herself. In the wisdom of hindsight, her apparent suicide became a public health warning. This fact, however, has only come out since her disappearance, and it shows the necessity of making known such matters to the proper parties at once. Had it been done in this case, no doubt, as Margaret was suffering puerperal fever, steps would have been taken to prevent her doing herself an injury. Police never questioned her husband's version of events, and despite claiming to have thoroughly investigated with neighbours, scant interviews were conducted. When recalled to an inquest 4 years later, Alice, a single mother and long-term Sandhills local, told how, "I knew Margaret and recollect her disappearing between 3 and 4 years ago. She had been confined 10 days before she disappeared and was very light-hearted in consequence of the derangement in her system. On the morning of the day on which Margaret disappeared, I spoke with her. Her child was taken from her by order of her husband. I never saw her again. I was informed the next morning by her husband that she had gone away. The husband's candlestick was found in the morning with a piece of candle in it. Another girl who was in attendance told me that Margaret had a basin of gruel, then left her home, dressed herself afresh, and went out about 10 o'clock and never came back. To a juror, I don't know where her husband was. Massey told me a day or two after that her husband was working over on the North Shore. I recollect there was a southerly buster that night."
The clear probability of the remains being Margaret placed an unexpected re-emphasis on the couple's marriage. Folk now remembered the husband publicly declaring, "It's a good job the brute's gone," just a day or two after Margaret's disappearance. Other stories surfaced, portraying a bullying and jealous 38-year-old husband who used his younger wife with great cruelty. Having never been interviewed in 1862, Margaret's brother-in-law confirmed the husband as being a very jealous and possessive man. "I have seen him strike his wife more than once when in a passion." He saw him manipulate Margaret's illness by threatening to keep the baby from her unless she did as he ordered. He remembered the husband coming to his glebe home the day after Margaret went missing before returning into town, as well as going with him to his own residence, which was situated on the Sandhills. The house was occupied partly by them and the other part by Massey. "When I went to the house, the Masseys were at home. We examined boxes to see if Margaret had taken any of her clothing with her. The clothes were scattered about the floor, but none was missing. The husband said there ought to be £5 and some other money in a stocking. The money was missing, but the stocking was there." They, the Masseys, were in the house all that night, but did not know when Margaret left. After confirming to the inquest that Margaret was red-headed, brother-in-law Joseph sadly apologised for his wife being unable to attend, as she had recently died in an asylum after a long illness.
Under the bold shafts of white light leaking through the Metropolitan Hotel windows, the new accumulating evidence also fractured Alice's seemingly honest and straightforward narrative, turning into the reckless rumour of someone aping whatever they were told at the time, while never actually witnessing anything. The Masseys and their carer were also, crucially, unavailable. The carer had left the country for San Francisco. Mrs. Massey had died from consumption in the months after Margaret's disappearance, and Mr. Massey drowned near Taree in late 1865. The inquest would hear that in the months after his wife's disappearance and the subsequent death of his child, the husband became singularly strange and gloomy in his habits, though certainly not from grief at her loss. After the Masseys moved out, he invited replacement lodgers to keep up with the rent. A fellow lodger, since dead, who slept in the same room with him, said he used to start up in the night in great terror and say that he could not sleep in the room. Margaret's husband used to conduct himself like a maniac, so that the lodger was glad to leave the room in a very short time, and said that nothing would induce him to dwell under the same roof again.
By 1864, Margaret's husband had returned to the water as crew on the pilot tug, The Zone. He was in a dinghy, lowered into rough waters during the recovery of a struggling coal bark cut adrift from its harbour mooring during a night storm. Four of the dinghy crew drowned after it capsized while attempting to untangle a mess of ropes pairing the tug to the bark. He would be one of four survivors remarkably fished out from the black water that night, though this was soon forgotten in a very public rancor of guilt and recrimination that followed. Later in that year, he signed on as a stowaway carpenter for the Royal Exchange that was making a detour to Adelaide from its regular San Francisco-Newcastle coal run. Being an uncontracted stowaway allowed him to work his one-way passage, but leaving Newcastle for the relative anonymity of a new town didn't halt his mental deterioration, and he died raving mad the following year in an Adelaide asylum. When this information was made public at the inquest, some Newcastle locals saw it as proof of a bad man's consummation by his guilt. In terms of the inquest narrative, though, he was just one person of interest, like the lodger and Mrs. Massey, who would never help illuminate the true story of Margaret's disappearance. The inquest would turn a single household's bedeviled past into a hauntingly ludicrous pattern of death. It would represent a frustrating silence perhaps only understood symbolically by reference to the nearby sandhills, remorselessly accumulating what they consumed. It nonetheless returned Margaret to the living, momentarily allowing her to be more than a female name unknown on the sandhill at Newcastle, who had died violently. But by what means, done when, why, and by whom, there is no evidence to show. Thank you for listening. This Dark Stories podcast has been narrated by David
and Elizabeth.
For more information, please search on www.darkstories.com.au or please visit hunterlivinghistories.com or join the author's Facebook page by searching for the Facebook group On Ground Level. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, and subscribe to receive future episodes. Until next crime, this case is closed.